Okay, everyone, welcome to another edition of the Big Questions with Big John. I am your host, Big John, and today we have a very special guest. He needs no introduction at all, as I am sure you could tell just by looking at him here on the screen, but I'm going to give it my best shot right now. My guest today really needs no introduction. You may know him as Kane, the towering masked powerhouse who once dominated the WWE ring as the Big Red Machine, striking fear into opponents with chokeslams and his fiery persona. However, he's traded the wrestling mat for the mayor's office, serving as the leader of Knox County, Tennessee since 2018. With a background that blends physical gift and an English degree, and a deep-rooted belief in individual liberty inspired by libertarian thinkers like Ludwig von Mises, today's guest brings a unique perspective to both the squared circle and the public square. Everyone, please welcome Mayor Glenn Jacobs. Mayor Jacobs, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. So let's start right at the beginning, as Homer might say. Tell me, I've read that you've had an interesting upbringing. You were born in Spain, actually, correct?
I was. My dad was in the Air Force at the time. He is a 21-year military veteran. He spent 10 years in the Navy. He was in the Korean War, then switched services and went to the Air Force. We weren't in Spain long, probably less than a year, went back to the U.S. And when I was 4 years old, Dad retired from the military. We moved to very rural northeast Missouri, up close to a town called Hannibal, which is the home of Mark Twain. I grew up on a farm 5 miles outside of a very small town in that area, about 350 people.
Wow, yeah. And switching from Navy to Air Force in itself sounds like a very adventurous thing to do, and arduous, I would think, right?
Yeah. Dad was on an aircraft carrier in the Navy, so really I think going to the Air Force probably wasn't that much of a learning curve because he was still working with airplanes. In the Air Force, he was load master on the C-130 cargo plane, so he was the person in charge of the weights and balances and all that sort of thing. The reason that he did that, I assume, was because in the Navy, you're deployed for months at a time at sea and don't get to be with your family. And the Air Force, a little easier in that. With the exception, he did go to Vietnam shortly after I was born, but otherwise, you know, my family lived with him on base. My brother and sister are older than I am. So as I said, he retired when I was four, so I didn't really get to moving around a whole lot. They did. They're 10 and 8 years older than I am. So I think they went to something like 6 different elementary schools or something like that. But nevertheless, I think the advantage of the Air Force over the Navy in his particular case was he was able to be with his family.
Now, when I've interviewed folks who have had servicemen and women for parents, my father was also a veteran of the Korean War. Do you find that that helps shape your views on the military, the service to country? Do you feel it almost gives you more of an appreciation of it, or perhaps a resentment of it? Which one do you think happened in your case?
It is an appreciation of the people in our military, the people that serve, which then, for me, becomes the main job, actually, of politicians should be to keep them out of harm's way as much as possible. Unfortunately, to me, our foreign policy has very much put our military members in harm's way when it shouldn't have. For instance, one of the 13 service people that were killed in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and don't get me wrong, obviously we needed to get out of there. I think it should have happened much earlier, though. But the whole thing was completely botched, in my opinion. But he was from here in Knox County. He was a graduate of Gibbs High School. And, you know, for me, when I think about my dad and that 21 years of service and 2 wars that he was in, really, you know, our military should be, it's the Department of Defense, and that's what it should be there for. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of politicians instead think, oh, we can do all this stuff around the world and we should be the world's policeman. Well, guess what? You're putting people like my father at risk when you do that.
Right.
And for no good reason, in my opinion.
Right. If you're not in direct defense of the country, I understand
right.
that you
exactly.
don't want to be interventionist or anything like that. I get it. Okay.
Right.
So as a young man, you've got this sort of appreciation of what it means to serve and duty, but also sort of a restraint of unmitigated political power. Now, as you're a young man and you're coming up in the heartland in Missouri, you know, I'm a native New Yorker, so some of these when I interview some guests, you know, they're from the heartland, you know, or something. It's totally foreign to me. I'm born and bred Bronx kid, you know, like this is, you know, I didn't see a cow till I married my wife and she took me somewhere where they had cows, you know, like that right. Sort of thing. So you're in the Midwest there. Like, what kind of sort of values did you grow up with? Like I'm assuming that if we're of the similar age, you may have become more aware of your environment, say, in the late 60s, early 70s. Turmoil, certainly, post-Vietnam, sure. Also the liberal explosion in the 70s. So what kind of environment were you raised in, and how did that shape your initial sort of awareness of what's going on?
My mom and dad were what I would describe as Goldwater Republicans, in that they were suspicious about big government. We didn't sit around the dinner table and talk politics or anything like that. But nevertheless, I think that was inculcated into me. My earliest memory, this is very strange, but my earliest memory was sitting in the back of our Volkswagen Dasher station wagon. And we were driving under some of the high voltage power lines, and it was going through a farm, and right through the middle of the farm, they have these fields, and you have these lines going through them. And, you know, we can argue about the practicality of that, obviously, but nevertheless, I remember my mom saying something about the evils of intimate domain and government just mm-hmm. taking people's property. That's my earliest memory. So that probably stuck with me. And just to be, I don't want to say suspicious, but just to be mindful of government and to realize that, you know, that when people do have power, we have to watch them very closely. I think for me in particular, because my brother and sister were quite a bit older than I am, I grew up pretty much as an only child living on a farm. So I had to learn basically self-sufficiency in that. I mean, I didn't have other people. Obviously, my folks took care of me and everything.
Right.
You know what I mean? It wasn't like I could go out and hang out with people or anything like that to the great extent. So I think for me, my personal experience shaped a lot of that self-reliance, realizing that you can't always depend on other people to do stuff for you. You certainly can't depend on them to clean up your messes. So just that upbringing was a little different than what a lot of folks have. I am a big free market person. I strongly believe that voluntary exchange is beneficial for everyone. But nevertheless, I think that those early years for me taught me also that I shouldn't, to the extent possible, I don't need to be overly reliant on other people. I need to be the person that makes things happen.
And you know, that's so interesting because obviously I could see where the roots of libertarianism, of voluntarism, like when you phrase it that way, it's very obvious to me that you were sort of incubated in this environment.
Right.
That would foster those thoughts, because so many folks that I speak to who do consider themselves libertarians or free marketeers or anarchists, take your choice, they almost have to circuitously come to it, almost like they had to go through either authoritarianism or liberalism or conservatism first, and then they said, wait, there's something missing. Oh wow, Mises, Friedman, Ron
sure.
Paul, you know, and then they sort of, it's like myself, I came to it through being a Barry Goldwater type of conservative, a Reagan conservative, seeing what was missing in that sort of positioning as a young man, and then eventually finding libertarianism. Whereas you are one of the first, if not the first person I've said that I've run into that sort of like, no, I was kind of raised in this, like, depend on yourself, you know, don't harm others, make things happen for yourself. So that's very interesting in that, like, it seems like I said, you were incubated into this sort of philosophy. In looking over your bio, I noticed that you have a degree in English. that when you went to university in Missouri, right?
Yeah.
You did end up with a degree in English. Was that something that you defaulted into, or did that actually come from a love of reading or from writing? How did you settle on a degree in English?
A little bit of both, actually. When I got to college, I graduated high school in 1985. So when I got to college, I was very interested in computers and computer science. My sister is actually a software engineer at NASA. She worked on the space station simulator, the space shuttle simulators that had a pretty big influence on me and throughout my upbringing. I looked up to her. So I wanted to get into computer science. But again, this is before the internet. And when we're talking computer science, I mean, we're talking like, this is how a computer works. You have to understand BASIC. You have to understand machine language, Fortran, COBOL. I mean, you're literally doing computer programming. Right. It's a lot different now. But in one of my great life decisions, I was like, well, this ain't going anywhere, and I don't want to spend the rest of my life confined behind a cathode ray tube, right? So I'm like, I'm gonna switch majors. And I've always been a big reader. I do love the social sciences. I love history. I love literature, and I wanted to teach and coach. At the time, I was playing basketball and then later football in college, and that's just what I wanted to do. So it was a little bit of both. I will tell you that even though I may not use my English degree formally, it does help me communicate. It taught me to be a better writer, to be a better communicator. And also, it's really interesting. You know, we often think, oh, we're going through a unique period in history. Well, when you read and go back and look at history, it's not the same thing that we're going through, but they're similar. Mark Twain once said that history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And it's pretty neat. You can go back, and even in ancient times, you can pull things out and apply it to today. And then what's really cool is you can look at wisdom from other periods and say, this is applicable to what's happening today as well.
I agree with you 100%. And even in our lifetimes, Mayor, I'll speak for myself. I know I'm at the age where I've seen things repeat themselves in my lifetime. I've seen political cycles and social change that right now I say, man, why can't these kids get it? I've seen this before, and I've seen it happening, and I know how this is going to end. But of course, I'm not the first generation that's ever said that. I'm sure you've said that, and people will say it about us, and so on and so forth.
There's a corollary to the saying that people, if you don't read history or you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. That corollary is those of us who had read history or learned from history are doomed to watch everybody else repeat it. And sure enough, that seems to be what happens.
That's actually a very – I had not heard of that corollary, but I think I'm going to steal it from you, Mayor, because it is very sage. Okay, so let's also talk now a little bit about a transition. So you're in college. You started out learning about computers, and I agree with you, by the way. My first degree was in computer science in 1984, I think.
And there you go.
I do remember coding in hex and binary, yep. So I absolutely get it. I feel you. Now, you said you were also a basketball player in college and a football player. Certainly, given your size and your athletic ability, that's perfectly reasonable, and people can see it a mile away. A typical story that I've heard of a lot of wrestlers that I've talked to, pro wrestlers that I've talked to, is that they were involved in other sports, like Mark Calloway, The Undertaker, famously, like, played basketball, and, you know, then had, I think, knee issues. Same thing with Kevin Nash. And they came to pro wrestling. We know of all the football players, Wahoo McDaniel and Big Cat Ernie Ladd. You could tell I'm a wrestling fan. they were stars in other sports, both collegiately and professionally, and sometimes an injury may have caused them to settle down and enter pro wrestling. Was that a similar path to you? Was it always something you were interested in? Were you recruited? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's actually my story as well. I had always been a fan, but more of a casual fan. I wasn't a hardcore pro wrestling fan. If it was on, I'd watch it. When I was a little kid, had to watch All-Star Wrestling out of Kansas City. And then once a month, we'd go to visit my grandmother in St. Louis, and I'd watch wrestling at the Chase, which was the show. That was the mecca of professional wrestling at the time. But I was interested in other sports. I played basketball in high school. And when I went to college on a basketball scholarship, I hadn't lifted weights in high school, and I ended up putting on a lot of weight. And the football coach actually recruited me to play football. He's like, son, you're not going to play in the NBA. I was like, you know, thanks, coach. I appreciate that. I already know that, but thanks. But with your size now, because I'd put on like 60 pounds. Like with your size, you might be able to play in the NFL. So I had some coursework left and could gain some eligibility if I switched sports. I didn't really have anything to lose. So what the heck? So I started playing football, and I was just naturally gifted at football because of my size and athleticism from playing basketball and all that. And yeah, then one day at the end of practice, we were putting in trick plays for that weekend's game. Silliest thing ever. I could have done this walking down the street. There was no contact, just walking through a play, and I managed to get my cleat stuck in a hole and blew out my left knee. Went to the Bears camp as an undrafted free agent, but I couldn't pass the physical because of my knee. So I had to figure out what to do with my life. And I still wanted to do something involving sports and involving athletics. As I said, I could have got into coaching, which would have been great, but I still wanted to perform. My entire life, ever since I was a little kid, revolved around sports. I mean, that was just what I wanted to do. So one day, a friend of mine and I were watching, at the time it was WWF on TV, and he said that you should try that. And I thought to myself, I'm big like those guys on TV. I'm still a good athlete despite having the not great knee. And with that English degree, I understand Shakespeare. So didn't want to get a real job. Again, didn't have anything to lose. And from there, I found a local group that was willing to give me some training, and went through the Midwest for a couple years, not making any money. And then finally got a break and went to Puerto Rico as my full-time job. And, from there, ended up in WWE a few years later. But that is my story as well. But that's also an illustration to me of it's the American dream in action. In our country, you're not confined by whatever, right? If you have the natural ability to do something, the only thing that holds you back is your imagination in determining how to use that to benefit other people and then to benefit yourself. I mean, that is actually the definition of entrepreneurialism, right? Is you figure out where there's a use for whatever, and you fill that use, you fulfill it. So that's the actual lesson. There's persistence in that you have to keep on going through whatever life throws in your way. And sometimes, for me, if I played the NFL, I mean, I'd probably played a couple years, but it would have been okay, right? But I had a 25-year career in wrestling, and it's just amazing. I traveled the world, entertained millions of people, and it's just been unbelievably I've been so unbelievably blessed in my life. But yeah, that's my story as well, as I got hurt and trying to figure out something else to do with my skills and just wanted to keep on playing ball, basically.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned your degree, knowing Shakespeare. You mentioned that, and that pops out to me because pro wrestling at its finest is Shakespearean storytelling at its core, right? And we've always heard the axiom of the best pro wrestlers are the ones who are able to take their personality and turn it up to 11. Like, it's their personality, but just magnified to a ridiculous multiplier, right? So you've, like most pro wrestlers starting out, you were given several gimmicks, several personas, and the one that stuck was finally Kane, right? I mean, Unabomber, Isaac Yankum, the evil dentist, right? So you had a couple. But when you settled on Kane, you feel that was particularly successful in part due to the situation in the writing, but also because it was closest to your personality that you were able to then project it out, again, using your knowledge of Shakespeare and sort of like the human psyche. How close is Kane to Mayor Jacobs in terms of personality traits? I mean, I know you don't go around slamming your opponents. I get it. But, like, how would you describe that relationship between Kane and Mayor Jacobs?
It's actually the opposite, and maybe that's why it's successful, because for me it was a form of escapism. And the fact that, yeah, Kane was such – for a lot of his career was so evil and dark, and that seriously is literally the opposite of me. I think there are some similarities. Kane is a loner and misunderstood by society and all of those things. But in the end, for me, I think the success actually came, especially as the character evolved, actually came from the fact that we were so different, and it allowed me. You know, most in wrestling, most of the characters are exactly what you say. They're real people whose personalities become, in some cases, kind of a stereotype or whatever, but they, you know, you turn up to 11 but it's still kind of you. Undertaker and Kane were really different because we are characters, you know, much like you would see in a movie or on a TV show. One of the really neat things, though, is we're able to take those characters, you know, this supernatural element, right? And it's almost like mythology where you have these two larger than life brothers. It's almost like Zeus and Poseidon or something like that, right? However, we were able to humanize that to where people bought it. And it wasn't just like you're watching a fantasy movie on wrestling. It was actually like, okay, these characters are real to some extent, but they're still characters. So for me, it was probably kind of the opposite of that, in that I got to play a character. And there were at times there were disadvantages to that, but there was also a lot of advantages in that, you know, I could just, with Kane, I could just, it was a blank slate. I could do anything I wanted. So some of those, I mean, you had the confines of the character and the constraints of the character, which everybody faces, but then you didn't have the, like, my own personality constraints. I could create almost an entire new personality.
Yeah. And I, in doing some research, I did find that most every other person associated with wrestling always describes you as being like the nicest guy on the planet. And nobody seems to have beef with you, Mayor Jacobs, in terms of off character, you know, and it does speak to that distinction you just described. Like, he was a character, maybe there were pieces of me in there, but it wasn't me. And what greater sort of testament to that than people, everyone to a person that I've heard in shoot interviews or whatever say, no, Glenn Jacobs is clearly like nothing like his character. Whereas you might not hear that about some other wrestlers, like,
yeah.
You know, well, not to put like Ric Flair, everyone says that character,
yeah,
is Ric Flair turned 11. Right?
He is.
Yeah,
he
exactly.
Is. He is. But in Undertaker's the same way. Mark is he's a great guy. And Mark's very interesting because he is a very private person. He's having a lot of success now with his podcast and doing some other things where you pull the veil back behind the Undertaker. But a lot of the reason that the Undertaker was so successful when he was in WWE active was because Mark never wanted the spotlight outside of the Undertaker, right? So he was able to create this mystique around the character just because you never saw Mark Calloway, you only saw the Undertaker. So it is kind of interesting to just see different personalities and different dynamics. As you said, you know, Ric Flair is the nature boy. He loves being the nature boy. I mean, that's if you know Rick, that's him. And some of the other folks are exactly what you see on TV is them. Obviously, again, turned up, but it is them. And sometimes that's the most successful as well. I think about a guy like R-Truth, who's one of the funniest people that I've ever met. And again, all he does is turn it up, but it's incredibly entertaining.
Exactly. One thing I've noticed is that for the percentage of the population that it would consider themselves libertarian, pro wrestlers, I've noticed more than, say, the population at large, there seems to be a larger percentage of pro wrestlers who either are libertarian or espouse libertarian. You could see the inklings of libertarianism. I think of yourself. I think of Val Venis. I think of, to some extent, Governor Ventura having that libertarian streak. Do you? What about pro wrestling? I think I know the answer to this, but I want to hear your perspective. What about pro wrestling do you think either attracts or creates people of a libertarian bent, would you say?
One thing is we're independent contractors, which means obviously we're not employees of the company. So we don't pay tax. We do not have our federal withholding taxes taken out of a paycheck. We actually have to pay that every 3 months. And for me personally, and again, I was already kind of going down the rabbit hole anyway. But when you have to write a big check out to the IRS and then you see how that money is used, you pay really close attention, and it can be infuriating. You know, we're seeing everything like right now with USAID, and, you know, the liberals are like, oh my gosh, and they do great stuff and blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, someone like me sitting there going, that's my tax dollars. Thank you so much for doing that. Right. So I love Milton Friedman. One has been a huge influence on me. Friedman helped bring in the withholding tax, and it was because that was during World War II, and they were trying to figure out a way, you know, to finance this whole thing. But if I were ever to become in a position to be president, which is not going to happen, or in a position to do this, the first thing that I would do is I would get rid of the withholding tax. If we still have an income tax, maybe President Trump gets rid of that, which would be great. But if we still have an income tax, I get rid of the withholding tax, because then people would have to write a check and they would go, wait a second. They're spending this money in ways I don't agree with. They're wasting this money, whatever. Instead of when you get your rebate or your refund, you would realize, oh my gosh, this is money that was taken from me to begin with. This is not some sort of bonus that just the government gives me. And Friedman even said himself later that the withholding tax, one of the things that it does is it really disincentivizes people from paying attention to how much they're paying in taxes and what that money goes for.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up while you were talking. Milton Friedman, it just goes to show his genius on one level. Even when he was completely wrong about what he was doing, he devised the most efficient, ruthless way to get it done.
Good point, yes.
You know, but I do believe that, you know, he lived to be a very old man. He said his only regret in life was the withholding tax.
Yeah. And then we have to give him a pass because he was young. He was working for the government and he had a job to do. And I think, yes, later in life, he did realize that was probably something that he would have taken back if he could have.
Absolutely. Absolutely that. So being independent contractors, seeing that big check go out, like I could see where that would turn every independent contractor into a libertarian.
Yeah.
Too sweet, you know. So and it's also probably why a lot of wrestlers end up living in places like Texas and Florida that don't have any state income taxes, right? So we need to get the pro wrestlers to join the LP and start promoting libertarianism, Mayor. What do you think about that?
You're exactly right about the states with no income tax. And that is why we have a lot of guys that live in Florida. We have some guys that live in Tennessee. That's part of the reason I stayed in Tennessee. I would have anyway, because my family's from here and it's a great place to live, but not having that income tax is a big deal. Same in Texas. I don't know anyone that lives in New Hampshire, but, you know, or Alaska, but, you know, same thing. Overall, though, policy-wise, it's very interesting. There was a big fight back in the early 2000s about an income tax in Tennessee. And Senator Marsha Blackburn was one of the leading voices pushing back against that, which is awesome. But at the time, the proponents of the income tax said that if we don't have an income tax, the state's going to go bankrupt. We currently have a $2.2 billion rainy day fund, and this year the governor is going to put another $32.5 million into it. So it's been the exact opposite. We've actually seen ourselves in such a much better fiscal situation than so many of the high tax states have. A friend of mine, Dr. Art Laffer, who studies all these things, he just came out with a book. He's the guy that basically developed the Laffer curve, shows that there is, for government purposes, for revenue purposes, there is an optimal point of tax. And it's not nearly as much as what people think it is, because what happens is when taxes start getting too high, folks will take action to avoid paying those taxes, right? But so what we're seeing around the country is these high tax jurisdictions like California, New York, they're losing people who are coming to the low tax jurisdictions like Florida, like Tennessee, like Texas, and that's causing us to become economic powerhouses. Really around the country, we're seeing a shift in economic power away from the Northeast especially and to the South. And I think a lot of that has to do with just allowing people to keep more of their own money.
I agree there. And I think that percentage, my memory could be off a little bit, but it's somewhere around 18-19%.
I
think that's the
tipping point. It's a lot lower than most people think that it probably is.
Yeah. And it's been proven again throughout history, because if you took an average of what income taxes on the federal level are as a percentage of GDP, it's always around that 18-20% number. That's why your flat tax advocates, to the ones that say even propose a minarchist state, they'll say, yeah, let's keep it there, no deductions, no nothing, just keep it at that 18-20%, because then it really does become a matter of spending, and you can then throttle down spending without too much grief on people who come to be dependent on
it. And not to get too much into policy wonkishness, but one of the things that drives me nuts is folks on the left will talk about the Trump tax cuts and how the federal government lost revenue. No, their revenue actually increased, and the reason is just things are dynamic, and a lot of times, you know, I'll even hear that, well, If we increase taxes by such and such percentage, we will see this much money coming in. It never works that way, because people will react to that incentive. And a lot of times when you increase taxes, you actually see less revenue coming in. When you decrease taxes, you actually see more revenue coming in. But so many people just see static, and, you know, it's just math. And if we do this, this is the result. Problem is, human beings are going to react to that incentive in different ways, and many times unpredictable ways.
Yeah, and sometimes against their own interests as well.
And that's true too.
Yeah, and not to get too wonkish, like you said, but I'll go one more for you. Jack Kemp, back in the mid-80s, someone that from an economic standpoint, a lot of people, even libertarians, could get on board with. You know, he just had a simple solution. He goes, just don't spend anything more, and we'll have a balanced budget in. Back then, it was 8 years, where he said, like, look, I'm not even saying cut anything. I'm saying just don't spend more. And people don't realize the language, to your point, that's used. Liberals love to say, oh, how are we going to pay for the tax cuts? And my answer is, like, how do you pay for someone robbing you? You know, it's theft avoidance. You're not paying. Nobody has to pay for anything. And then a spending cut is an increase below what was anticipated, right? So they'd say, well, we were supposed to get 10% more. We got 5% more. That's a 5% cut. When in reality, it's nothing, right? So if you just kept that flat, we'd have now I think it's around 12 years. If you just stop spending, our productivity would balance our budget. But let's not go down that rabbit hole. I think we get the point.
We can talk about this all day.
yes, sir, we could. Your political career, let's quickly talk about that. What motivated you to run for mayor of Knoxville County?
When I was growing up, my family didn't have a whole lot because of Dad's military retirement. We always had a place to live, always had something to eat. He worked in factories and was laid off a lot. This was the Carter years, and it was really economically depressed area that we lived in as well.
Stagflation for people.
Yeah, and for me, my mom and dad worked really hard, and there was always this feeling that we're barely keeping our head above water. So for me, I knew that when I grew up, I didn't want to feel like I was ever living paycheck to paycheck. I thought that my pathway to success would be through sports. That's a lot of the reason for my motivation to get into. When I was a little kid, I played baseball, terrible at it. Being tall and everything, I started playing basketball because I had a competitive advantage there. And then ultimately, football. But nevertheless, you know, I got hurt playing football and then kind of fell into something that probably turned out a lot better than football would have had for me. And going back to the American dream, I've been a product of that. I mean, I think about my life and the fact that I started out, my family didn't have any money. We didn't have any connections, no political connections, no business connections, nothing like that. And I found something I was good at, and my life has been amazing. And that is the American dream. I mean, that to me, right. That's it. And I'm a product of that. And it's very important to me that that goes on. I'm a big believer in what Ronald Reagan said, that freedom is never more than a generation away from extinction. And we were talking earlier about when you look back through history. Well, it's the same thing. The same arguments that are always made against freedom, the same arguments that have been going on literally now for millennia, right? And those of us, I believe, who have just been incredible beneficiaries of the free enterprise system, of the American dream, I think we have a responsibility to make sure that at least for our kids and grandkids, we do what we can to say, hey, this is still going to be here for you. And at some point, it's going to be your obligation to make sure that your kids and grandkids can also experience this. So that was it. And even the neat thing, though, is even as county mayor, I mean, I get to do some stuff, I think, that does help, that does promote that. You know, here in Knox County, we're adamant about keeping taxes low. We're adamant about being friendly, business friendly. I think that the most important thing really that a government can do, we don't create jobs. Obviously, it drives me nuts when politicians say they create jobs, but we can nurture an environment where job creation is possible and is encouraged. To me, the most important thing is that people have economic opportunity. Because when they have that, they can improve their lives. And then a lot of times the stuff that local governments have to deal with, we don't have to deal with anymore. Or at least, you know, I would much rather have people fuss at me about potholes or the grass needing mowed somewhere than I would, I don't know how I'm going to put food on my table. Right. So it's just that, man. It's just, you know, the fact that I've had such a great life, and I just want to make sure that to the extent I can, that future generations also get to experience that.
And that's quite admirable, to be honest with you. I've never had the stomach for politics as a participant. I'll be honest with you. While I'll sit here and talk to great people like yourself about politics and to any extent that I could help spread the word about libertarianism, I will. But I know from my own experience, like I tried going to a local party meeting. I swore it off that night. I 2 hours of it, and I swore it off, Mayor. I said, I cannot do this anymore. So I do give you all the credit in the world for taking what your belief is and then actually implementing it. So many kudos to you. When you first ran, did you have trouble putting across your libertarian beliefs on two levels? One, the Libertarian Party, it exists. It's the third largest party. It's not winning anything major anytime soon. The system is rigged against it for a lot of different reasons, ballot access, being kept off debate stages and so forth. So that libertarian candidates who want to get elected, say beyond their local sphere, might have trouble unless they join up with either the Democrats or the Republicans. But in terms of when you were stumping, when you were putting your ideas out, did you find that the people were receptive to your libertarian theme messaging, or did you have to work and kind of put that across in a way more people could understand, more people could relate to?
Well, obviously around the country we have different flavors of conservatives. You have different flavors of Republicans. I'm a Republican. I would consider myself a conservative. That probably means something a little different here in Tennessee than it might mean other places around the world, around the country. We actually have a strong streak of libertarianism here. We believe in freedom. So it was actually not hard for me at all, because the things that I was talking about, you know, we're speaking the same language as the founding fathers. Right. And that's just something I think that resonates with people. And I think at their core, most people understand look, if you're not hurting anyone, just the government should leave you alone, frankly. You know, that's, again, that's kind of the message. So down here, it wasn't like I had to go out and say, oh, we're going to cut all these programs and everyone freaks out because who's going to do this and who's that going to do that. My predecessor in office is now Congressman Tim Burchett. And there's actually, it was an advantage because I come in and everything was running very well. I couldn't go in and take a chainsaw to things, right? Like I would have wanted to, but it was also a disadvantage. I couldn't come in and take a chainsaw to things like I would have wanted to. But people like Congressman Burchett, people like former Congressman Duncan, they're just, emblematic of here in East Tennessee. They're also both very anti-war. They're both very non-interventionist. Jimmy Duncan thought he was going to lose his seat because he voted against the Iraq War. He was one of the few people in Congress to do that. So I was fortunate here because I think that my values, especially what I really believe is important, that's what we all think here. So it wasn't, I mean, you know, I tell people all the time, there are a lot of places I could not be mayor in. New York City, I probably could. Probably couldn't do it. You know, nope. California, I probably wouldn't be really good at it. And Illinois, at least parts, in general, you think Chicago, Los Angeles, right? Yeah, I mean, people just wouldn't agree with me and I would be miserable. Whereas here, it's like, everybody pretty much, for the most part, agrees with me. And sometimes you do have to articulate things in a way that makes sense. But, you know, it just kind of goes back to that around the country. You just, you know, we're all different. And I would say broadly that our political leanings here in East Tennessee have a pretty strong liberty streak in them.
Well, that's great to hear. And since you mentioned it, you're absolutely right. Like your politics and your approach would not play in New York City, would not play in San Diego or Los Angeles or Chicago. Absolutely. But what I'm seeing lately, both on the Republican and the Democrat side, and to a large extent on the between the different libertarian factions, right? I'm not an anarchist, but I appreciate their point of view, but I'm just not an anarchist. I'm more of a minarchist, right? I'm a Milton Friedman guy. I'm not even a Ron Paul guy. I'm a Milton Friedman guy. Do you view, like, if you're a Republican, do you view Democrats and liberals as evil or wrong? And I think that goes to the heart of what's going on in this country right now, Mayor.
I view them as wrong. I don't think that they're evil people, especially the average person. I think that they're misguided, and I think that they ignore evidence of the real world, and they very much cherry pick what they want to think and what they want to believe. I'm not a big fan of John Maynard Keynes, obviously, but. But he did once say that he changed his mind about something and someone asked him, why'd you do that? And he's like, well, when I come upon new information, sometimes that changes my mind. And I don't think and that's true of me. In fact, the reason I believe what I believe is because over the years I've believed other things and then information I've come across information that I'm like, I'm completely wrong about that. You know, so you always have to keep an open mind. And I think that a lot of folks on the left are just so, just so fossilized in their thinking that they can't believe anything else. And also now it's happened with Donald Trump is this literal hatred of Donald Trump. I thought that we were all for cutting waste in government. And all of a sudden, Elon Musk is the most evil person on the planet because he's cutting waste in government because he's trying to get rid of fraud. But obviously, you know, yes, there are some evil people in the world, and that is a nonpartisan thing, unfortunately. But for the most part, I think the vast majority of people on the left, I think that they're just wrong and they're misinformed. But I also think that they are incredibly close-minded and that they won't consider anything else than what they already believe.
Yeah, and at least that's something you can work with, right? If you approach that someone is wrong, that gives you an opportunity to persuade them. Whereas if you think they're evil, you tend to write them off. And unfortunately, I think politics has evolved to that point, Mayor, where we think the other tribe is evil instead of just wrong. and we cease trying to persuade, and we're instead trying to just write them off and make sure they never win another election, et cetera. And it's a little disappointing, honestly, as I get older to just see that increase. I'm sure you do as well.
I can definitely agree with that. And unfortunately, and I don't know what that means for our country, because we just can't agree on anything anymore. Especially when you look at just the geographical differences. You know, I was talking about how in East Tennessee, we're just a little different. I would say a lot different than other parts of the country. You know, that's why the 10th Amendment was so important, was because your state decided a lot of these things instead of the federal government. So now we have one size fits all policies that impact everybody, and we have to fight over that. So, you know, ultimately for the future of our country, I think that we need to really reestablish the 10th Amendment, really reestablish states making the majority of decisions as opposed to the federal government. Because I am concerned that these differences that we have, if we don't figure out a way to be able to agree on some stuff, I don't see how the country can continue. At some point, I think that reaches a boiling point, and that's going to be very bad.
That's a great point. Obviously, you've been mayor since 2018. Your constituents probably love you. Are you perhaps looking to progress your political career, or are you happy being the mayor of Knoxville County?
Well, one thing that we've done here in Knox County is I am term limited, and I think that's a good thing. You know, I'm very much in favor of term limits on Congress. I think that one of the problems that we have is career politicians that lose, basically fall out of touch with the people that they're supposed to represent. So we've done that here in Knox County, which means in September of 2026, I'll be looking for another job. I don't know what that is at this point. I do not consider this position a stepping stone. I want to do the best that I can while I'm Knox County mayor. And then it reminds me a lot of what happened to me in my football career. And sometimes, you know, we have plans, and life has different plans. So I don't know. I just don't know, you know, and like what you're doing, you know, I think that the folks that have influenced me the most, in many cases, and they weren't politicians, they're writers, they're academics, or they're economists, but they still have a voice. And you think about that now with the internet and with social media and the ability to disseminate information. I wouldn't be where I am if the internet didn't exist. You know, I mean, I would have never been able to read Mises or to come across F.A. Hayek or even Henry Hazlitt. That just wouldn't have happened. So I think that the bright side for those of us that believe in liberty is the fact that it does work. It's the most practical system out there. It right. works the best of any system that man. You know, man didn't devise it, but it works the best of any system that we have devised. And the more people that are exposed to these ideas, and at some point you realize, like, you know, with Ron Paul, you know, and some of the things he's been talking about for decades are now happening. And, you know, people used to write it off, but now if you go back and read what he said in speeches before Congress, like, my gosh, it's almost like the guy had a crystal ball. He didn't have a crystal ball. He just applied common sense and his political and economic philosophy, and this is the natural outcome. But so I'm not sure, but there's the wonderful thing about the world that we live in now is there's just all sorts of opportunities. So whether I stay in politics or not, I will still stay in the game, I guess.
That's a great way of putting it, and I think that's a good break point for us, because I agree with you. I do think the internet, I only wish I was 20 again so I could start my journey on the internet again, because I think I would have done a lot more with my life. Mayor Glenn Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us. I love talking to you. But before we go, I have a section that I end all my interviews with. It's called Silly Questions. Just five questions for you, just to get let the folks get a better appreciation of Mayor Jacobs and your personality. So let's start off. No right or wrong answer. First one, which law or regulation do you feel is the most stifling to individual liberty in this country? I think you answered it, but I'll let you go at it again.
I would, well, there's two. The income tax is a terrible policy. Ultimately, though, I believe at the heart of everything is the Federal Reserve System and the fact that the government just prints money, and that's how we've gotten in all this debt. It causes all sorts of economic dislocations and all sorts of other things. So I really hope that DOGE is able to go and audit the Fed, and I believe that what is brought to light will make the American people realize that it's just that it's central banking and the control that the Fed is able to exert over the economy is very destructive.
That's a great answer. And the Fed, that's fantastic. Next question. I know, and I'm certainly not feeling like I'm living up to my nickname, Big John, when I have Mayor Jacobs on the show with me. Mayor Jacobs, how tall are you again?
I'm about 6'8".
6'8", okay. At 6'3", I'm a dwarf compared to you. But I know in my career, when I was on Wall Street, I had to be taught by my superior saying, like, you're too big, you're too intimidating, don't stand so close to people, you're Greek, don't wave your arms around, you're scaring people away, we don't need our clients scared away. Do you feel that your physical size has been a help or a hindrance in politics?
Oh, it's a huge help because, yes, I can be intimidating if I want to, I'm kind of natural that way,
yeah.
But then people realize, oh, it's that contrast. It's like, oh, he's actually a really nice guy. Hopefully they think I'm thoughtful and all those things. So basically I consider it a tool in my toolbox and just how I want to deploy it.
Perfect. A gentle giant, so to speak.
There you go.
The old thing. What's your guilty pleasure that people might be surprised to find out about you?
I love pizza, so especially when I was still wrestling, I would on a very strict diet. I was followed the keto caveman diet before that was really a thing. Man, if you put down a super supreme pizza in front of me, it'll be gone. Trust me.
Fair enough. Hey, look, I'm on keto. I'll make you a keto pizza. I don't know if it'll be good, that supreme, but okay, fair enough. If you could live in any historical time period besides now, which one would you pick and why?
It would be the revolutionary period in American history because it transformed the world. It wasn't only a revolution here. It was really a revolution of thought. You know, some of the ideas had been around for a while. You think about Jefferson and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which John Locke had talked about, and the Enlightenment thinkers. But nevertheless, the American Revolution was really the first time in history that you had these ideas that a government was supposed to be there to serve the people, not the other way around, that it was really about protecting the rights of the individual as opposed to making the king rich, all of those things. And you had just an incredible number of thinkers and really in people that are willing to put everything on the line. The folks that signed the Declaration of Independence, when they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, they're actually doing that. If they had not won the war, they would have all been hanged. They would have been hanged as traitors. So whatever deficits that they might have had, still, I mean, you know, the fact that they were willing to do that and it changed the world, I would love to go back and just talk with Thomas Jefferson or talk with Samuel Adams or talk with George Washington because, you know, our world, you know, there's a lot of issues in our world. But if you look at the state of the world from where it has been centuries ago, we're in such a better place, and a lot of it is because of them and the ideas that they put into action.
Right, I agree. That's a great answer, by the way. If Ron Paul were a pro wrestler, what would his gimmick and finishers be?
I don't know exactly what his name would have been, but I'm sure he would have had a heck of a feud with Earl R. Scheister, IRS, and he probably would have put him in the, let me think here. It would have been like the free market clutch. So
some sort of abdominal stretch or something.
There you go. Like exactly. Yes.
that's a great answer. I thought I might stump you with that one on the spot, but you came through, Mayor. You came through. And I saw this on a recent comedy special by Big J. Okerson, so I thought I'd throw it out to you. Let's assume Mayor Jacobs has now gone rogue. He's on the lam from the law, shacked up in a motel somewhere, and at his front door are an array of police squad cars. Mayor Jacobs, how many female cops would it take to subdue you if they were coming at you two in the
day? Oh, that I've never thought about that before.
You know, crazy 88 style, like in Kill Bill.
Actually, I'll tell you, some of them are highly trained. They're pretty tough. So it may not be as many as people think, right? I don't know. I just hope I'm never in that situation.
And that proves that you are indeed a political creature, Mayor Jacobs. Everyone, this has been Mayor Glenn Jacobs. Thank you so much for joining us on the Big Questions with Big John. Mayor, is there anything you want to let the folks know before we sign off, somewhere where they can either contact you, follow your career, whatever?
Sure. My X handle is Glenn Jacobs TN. It's Glenn with two N's. So GlennJacobsTN. I'm also on Instagram as the same. And then you can follow me on two places on Facebook. We have Knox County Mayor Glenn Jacobs. And then my campaign Facebook page where I kind of post everything else. That's Jacobs for Mayor.
Everyone, check all those sites. I will put them up in post here. And before we sign off, I want to apologize. On occasion, I may have said Knoxville because I probably have a jackass on the mind and I keep thinking of Johnny Knoxville. So I apologize to the good citizens of Knox, Knox County. So Mayor Glenn Jacobs, thank you. A pleasure. I know you're a busy man, so thank you for taking some time to talk to me. I really appreciate it. And for everybody else, join us on the next episode of the Big Questions with Big John when I'll have someone perhaps as interesting as Mayor Jacobs we could talk to. Until then,
thanks, John. Peace, everyone.